All right, and we're in. Adam, how you doing today, my man?
Doing all right. Thanks, Jake. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Glad to have you. You're a legend in the space, so this is going to be a fun one, especially for my audience, because I think a lot of this podcast audience is Bitcoin Class 2017, Bitcoin Class 2021, so newer vintage, and we hear about things like Counterparty, but I don't think most people really know what it means. So I want to get into Counterparty in a roundabout way, and it's through shitcoins on Bitcoin. It's some people hate it. They want to kind of separate Bitcoin and crypto, and like pre-ordinals, that line was still pretty strong, but now I think it's just totally broken the mold. So maybe kind of like, because you've been here so long, that refrain of shitcoins on Bitcoin and like Counterparty, what was it like back then? And like, how does it compare to the current kind of narrative and how it's holding in Bitcoin or not?
It's a interesting topic. The narrative has definitely changed, and also, like, everything old is new again. At the time, so I got started really building in the blockchain space 2013, and it happened pretty quickly. It was a very exciting time. Bitcoin was very, very, very much the center of the whole ecosystem and the center of gravity for all projects. Everything was more or less on Bitcoin or just like a copy of Bitcoin. And there had just started to be these altcoins or alternative protocols that were cropping up, but they were all very small, amateurish, had no funding. And to Bitcoin was this, yeah, it was this planet that everything was circling around. And there was the discussion then was centered around also the Bitcoin Core developers and sort of what they wanted to do with Bitcoin, what was the future of Bitcoin, right? It wasn't so established at the point that Bitcoin would be so static and stable. And pretty much the way that it played out, as I understand it, is there was a strong push for innovation, just development of the technology, right, which people could see were useful for things other than payments. Satoshi himself saw that blockchains were useful for things other than payments. And Bitcoin didn't move. Bitcoin didn't want to change. The core developers didn't want it to change, and they were very conservative, even reactionary towards any projects that wanted to sort of extend Bitcoin or change Bitcoin or what have you. And this culminated in the op return wars of 2014 when Counterparty and a couple of other projects were trying to extend the functionality of Bitcoin by building on top of it, by using this meta protocol architecture, by sort of sticking metadata, extra data inside Bitcoin transactions and extending the functionality that way. And there was a lot of backlash against it. People were worried about the future of Bitcoin. They were worried about block size, that they were worried about the shitcoinification of Bitcoin. There hadn't really, at that point, been other successful projects that had transcended shitcoin status. And what happened is, because Bitcoin couldn't change and adapt, other protocols and other projects flourished. They raised a ton of money. They launched their own projects and protocols, built whole ecosystems that, of course, have been in many ways more vibrant than Bitcoin's itself, even as Bitcoin is still, the center of the ecosystem, the most valuable coin, to gold, to, every other silver. And from that point on, there was a continued reaction to those other projects, which was understandable. That sort of morphed into Bitcoin maximalism, right? This belief that Bitcoin is the one true currency, and that's and anything else is inherently a shitcoin.
So there's a ton there, super interesting. One that comes to mind is, nowadays everyone's launching a meta protocol. So everyone's leveraging the L1 as truth and then putting a kind of like AR lens above it. But it sounds like back then it was the opposite, which was that meta protocols were like niche and forking Bitcoin was kind of like the standard, the
Yeah.
main way you would do it, which seems like a heavier lift. Meta protocols seem to make more sense, but like, what was the was there a different response to meta protocols or colored coins versus upright forks, or were they both kind of like synonymous with like we don't want them?
At the time, colored coins were sort of considered an interesting idea, interesting tech, but no one was really very excited about them. They're very limited in what they can do, and the ecosystem hadn't matured enough to like the there wasn't enough financial maturity in the industry to support sort of tokens and an NFT ecosystem, which didn't exist at the time. As everyone, they were at the time, I don't know, maybe by 2013, 2014, there were four or five, six different colored coins protocols, and no one really used them. They weren't very exciting. And I mean, there were the way that IO is envisioned Counterparty was as an extension to Bitcoin. It was based on Bitcoin. Bitcoin was the primary token, and there were ways of doing more and reusing all of that infrastructure. And that was, yeah, in contrast to merge mining, which was very popular at the time, and sidechains were the other sort of architectural pattern that was created around then by Blockstream in the Liquid protocol and a few others, Liquid Network. And so the battle was really between sidechains and meta protocols, where the Bitcoin Core developers were supporting sidechains because they had their own sidechain. They liked it from an architectural perspective. And then colored coins were no one was very excited about.
Got it. And then you mentioned something about the core devs had like a bunch of say, which seems like this is changing nowadays somewhat. And it seems like the line of thinking is something like Bitcoin core or core devs can be a sign of centralization. And so we're trying to figure out whatever consensus means, which we'll figure out how we upgrade the next, soft fork. But it seems like back then there was less aversion to that, or maybe it was just so new that like they were the elite, they were the stewards of Bitcoin, so we kind of listened to that. Was that kind of how it was back then?
Yeah, everyone was really worried about the miner centralization at the time. That was the big concern because the mining pool, the big mining pool just getting started, people didn't understand the dynamics, the economics there, and no one was really worried about the centralization in the protocol development. And yeah, now it's sort of, and that was where the block size debate came around, because the block size debate, which was very, very big, was about larger blocks versus smaller blocks versus blocks of the same size. And larger blocks were supposed to encourage central miner centralization because it takes more time for a large block to propagate. And so it's harder to spin up a smaller mining pool. That's what everyone was worried about. And then now I see miners as being a really important counterbalance to the developers, right? The miners actually play an active role in determining the Bitcoin protocol, which is frankly how Satoshi envisioned it, right? It's what makes sense from the design of Bitcoin. You want the miners, of course, the miners are supposed to choose what version of the software they're running. And at the time, they didn't really. It was the case that when the Bitcoin Core developers put out a patch to limit the use of, or the ease of use of, the Bitcoin protocol for meta protocols, they limited the size of the hopper turn. There was no controversy around actually the adoption of that piece of software that they had pushed out. Everyone was just like, of course, yeah, the Bitcoin Core developers said it was good and important. And no one thought about no one thought about the actual usage and the transaction fees and the economy and all of the tokenomics of that change.
Got it. Interesting. Okay, I want to touch on like the philosophy of fungible tokens here in a sec, but you mentioned something about hopper turn, and this is kind of a there's been a big debate over the current year of standardness versus consensus, and like what's the point of some things in standardness, and they're kind of like legacy that was just one decision was made, no one pushed back, so it stays there. And hopper turn limit seems like one of those things. So because you were there, like, is that kind of how it played out, which is just like no one raised up too much of a huff?
Yeah, it was the same thing where the Bitcoin Core devs changed the standardness rules to limit hopper turn transmission, right? To limit the relaying of transactions with an op return larger than 40 bytes. And the protocol itself wasn't changed. The actual, you know, what constituted a valid transaction or valid block wasn't changed. And there wasn't a big debate about it. They just sort of did it and everyone just sort of accepted it. And people weren't, again, they weren't worried about decentralization in the, you know, the power in the court apps.
Got it.
It's a healthy debate to have. I think it's a very important thing. Glad that it's happening.
Right. 100%. I want to get into like broadly fungible and non-fungible tokens. So alternative tokens as close to Bitcoin as possible. Because for a long time, it was just like BTC, all the things, and all of their tokens are basically useless. 99.9% are, you know, shouldn't exist. And like, that will play out probably to be true. Like, I'm in that camp too. But I'm glad people are experimenting. And so it sounds like the, especially Counterparty, but some of the fork people were contrarian at the time. So like, what was the appeal for you to even try and bring and like, you know, spend all the mental cycles to build something like this, to bring alternative tokens closer to Bitcoin?
Yeah, I think that one of the remarkable things that the development of cryptocurrency proved is how important and useful a token can be in the creation of a decentralized protocol. There had been decentralized protocols before Bitcoin. There was BitTorrent, there was emails in a decentralized protocol. And since then, there's been IPFS, for instance. But the token itself is very critical to the operation of any decentralized network because it can incentivize for usage. And moreover, it can protect against bad usage. And in our particular case with the Counterparty, we sort of immediately saw the need for an additional token, XCP, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to have the functionality that Counterparty has. And you need that token for a lot of the stuff that you want to do if you want to do more than just, you know, create minimal tokens and send them around. And it also creates a virtuous cycle. But it's just strictly necessary if you want, like Bitcoin wouldn't work without Bitcoin. And if you want to extend Bitcoin beyond a certain point, you need another token that understands and is aware of those protocol extensions. It's just critical. And with Counterparty, we always use Bitcoin wherever we could, wherever it was sufficient. And then we used our native token whenever we needed to add additional functionality that Bitcoin wasn't sufficient for.
It's so easy when you grok it that like tokens are incentives for human behavior. And it's why Bitcoin works. So it's like we already have the King example. And it's very odd that we treat Bitcoin as like this, you know, immaculate conception and set apart wholly. But then same incentive behavior of tokenization wholly doesn't work in the rest of crypto. It's very odd.
Yeah, see, here's how I see it. The financial networks and blockchains in particular create a lot of important virtuous cycles where you have the protocol development, and the protocol development gets people excited about the token. The token appreciation allows the creation of a healthier ecosystem, developers who then work on the protocol and the infrastructure on top of it. And there's this very, very important virtuous cycle that occurs when you're in a given network, when you're working in a given protocol, and when your projects are interoperable because of that. And what we saw, precisely because Bitcoin was so statist, is all the interesting projects, all of the brain power moving off chain into Ethereum and other altcoins. And so when this brain drain occurred, when all of the energy and excitement shifted away from Bitcoin, because Bitcoin wasn't allowed to change because of the core developers, there was also a loss of value, right? The Bitcoin didn't do as well as it would have if all those projects had stayed in the same ecosystem and there had been an actual proper incremental, collaborative, interoperable evolution of that single network. Instead, there have been many, 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 many protocols. And I think the ecosystem has become a lot more centralized because of it, because you need to, you know, move value from one chain to another. You're going to do it through whatever, a centralized exchange or a centralized protocol generally, or an escrow agent. And I think that instinctively, the, you know, what are now called maximalists, knew that all of that value was leaving, knew that it was problematic for the network effect. It reduced the network effect when all of those developers and all that interest and all that excitement moved off chain. And it's what's even worse is that a large chunk of those projects that, you know, a large chunk of the altcoins are shitcoins, right? They're total scams. I don't know, 95% plus. And it didn't have to be that way, I guess. The best outcome is when you can have new coins. The problem isn't new coins. The problem is new shitcoins. And the problem is new shitcoins where there isn't any interoperability, where there isn't that virtuous cycle, where you have a splintering of the ecosystem instead of a growth of the ecosystem. And it's possible to have new coins that interact in a healthy, productive way with each other. And new protocols that interact with a healthy, productive way instead of just copying and splitting off and, you know, doing an ICO, you know, pumping and dumping.
Yep, well said. Okay, let's sort of dive into Counterparty, and not a thumbs down, this is a thumbs up, but give us a brief overview of what it is, and then start to bring us into real time in the way that where has Counterparty been over the years? Because as a new-ish Bitcoiner, I've heard of it again, but it sounded like it was kind of like a defunct project that was just like sitting idle. So, like, give us an overview of what it is and kind of how it's been brought up into 2021 when we had, like, the last big bull run. And then we can get into the weeds of what you guys have been cooking over the past year.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting history. Counterparty is one of the first blockchain 2.0 projects, what we called it back then, Bitcoin 2.0 project. And it had a lot of firsts. It was really the first protocol with smart contracts beyond what Bitcoin script can do, like basic time lock or multi-sig or something like that. We launched in January 2014 with a working protocol, a working decentralized trustless exchange, working token creation, betting functionality for prediction markets, oracles, et cetera, all on chain, no ICO. It got a lot of interest and excitement. It was really the only thing in that space. The original idea for the architecture had come from MasterCoin and this guy named J.R. Willett, who ended up not really building much. And I and a couple other guys worked on Counterparty just sort of pro bono for about a year. And it got a lot of that initial interest because you could do all these things in Counterparty that otherwise were not possible in the entire blockchain space. It didn't exist yet. Eventually the Ethereum white paper was published and they did their ICO and all of that. And then a lot of interest eventually shifted there. But by the end of 2014, we'd built a lot of what Counterparty can do, which was all, you know, this, you know, we'd extended, we'd done trustless gaming. We made this decentralized exchange more powerful. We made all sorts of improvements that, you know, sort of how do you, you know, to how Counterparty works. And then partly for personal reasons and partly because the protocol already had all this functionality that, you know, people still needed to adopt, I and the other co-founders left the project. And we sort of handed it off to the community. We said, listen, the protocol is pretty stable. It works. It can do all the stuff that people were asking for. And there wasn't really another game in town at the time. And we left it off to the community. And unfortunately, the project became very dormant and neglected even for about 8 years. Up until the very beginning of this year, it didn't have the protocol had a few changes that had some important useful features, but also caused problems that the code rotted. The test suite started breaking. The performance got really terrible. And in January of this year, it took weeks to spin up a Counterparty node. That's all just from catching up because it wasn't really maintained. And in that time, Counterparty had sort of birthed a significant number of historically very important projects. Rare Pepe is maybe being one of the most important ones. Spells of Genesis, the first trading card game on a blockchain. Some of the earliest NFTs, depending on how you define them. I mean, definitely like the second or third, you know, NFT. And so Counterparty had all of this value on top of it because of its historical role, but it wasn't maintained. And it was even the maintainers were actually kicking projects off of Counterparty because they didn't like them. And I came back at the beginning of this year, along with a couple other people, to try and rejuvenate the project, trying to build what people are calling Counterparty 2.0, taking this historical protocol, this meta protocol, which is the center of so much value built on top of Bitcoin, and fix it up, improve it, make it more usable, and extend it all following the spirit of the original project.
Interesting. I want to double click on the things you guys are specifically updated, but real quick, it does seem like this is a case of like right tech, wrong time somewhat. And Ordinals really, especially for me, like I started on an L2, like on Stacks, because I wanted, you know, obviously Bitcoin, but I wanted to do more. And Ordinals really broke the glass ceiling of like what is possible in Bitcoin and what's allowed and like the Overton window. So is that a big like watershed moment for like your change? Is that the tech works and Ordinals has proven that the market is now somewhat ready for it? So maybe now it's time for, as you said, Counterparty 2.0.
Yeah, I think it's objectively true that Counterparty was that it's time by a few years. And yeah, I think Ordinals is super exciting. I think that all this excitement around Bitcoin L2s is really very well warranted. It goes back to this narrative that I was talking about, where Bitcoin can actually be a platform that supports a lot of development and innovation and value creation. And that's partly what got me excited, definitely. I also saw Counterparty just sort of having this opportunity that wasn't, you know, being taken advantage of. And I'm really excited to, you know, make Counterparty usable again, right? Make it extensible again, bring it back to the center of innovation in the Bitcoin L2 space, which it used to be and can be again, and is right now, frankly.
I love it. So then what's the, people are calling it Counterparty 2.0, which is a suite of big upgrades that are making, you know, it's some quality of life stuff, making the node run better, but also some new features. On the new feature side, what is either released? Is it already out now or like what's coming soon?
No. It's released. We just made the release last Wednesday, Thursday. This is one of the big release, the first protocol change since I took back over development of the protocol, which is the core version 10.4.0. And yeah, it's a bunch of features, which some of which were just asked for by the community, just like, you know, bug fixes, incremental improvements, and some of it is really big stuff. The biggest thing is what's called atomic swap support or UTXO support. And this is interesting philosophically. It's a major protocol change that allows Counterparty to integrate much more deeply with Bitcoin than it ever had before. Counterparty was always a meta protocol and sort of used Bitcoin as a dumb data store, just sort of put metadata inside Bitcoin transactions, but it intentionally sort of ignored all of the features of how Bitcoin worked in its regular operation. And seeing all this excitement and all the activity in the L2 space in Ordinals and Runes and so forth, the idea was had by a community member to extend Counterparty so that it would actually be aware of the movements of UTXOs of outputs in the Bitcoin protocol, like a colored coins protocol. So Counterparty now has, as of last Wednesday, all of the best features of a sort of a general meta protocol, which is that it can do arbitrary smart contracts and the deep integration with Bitcoin that a colored coins protocol like Ordinal does. So you can actually take your Counterparty asset, your rare Pepe or whatever, and then you can put it into a UTXO and then you can move that output around using vanilla Bitcoin software, and you can do an atomic swap between that Counterparty asset and Bitcoin, or an atomic swap between that and a Rune, what have you. So that deeper integration with Bitcoin is really a very important innovation. It's sort of always been possible, but no one had the idea, and the excitement around the L2 space is sort of, you know, I think what gave birth to it. And that protocol change was implemented and it's out there. It was released. It will be active in 3 weeks or so. There's a month-long activation period for everyone to upgrade. So from that point on, among other things, counterparty, you'll be able to do atomic trustless single transaction swaps between counterparty assets and other L2 coins, and use vanilla Bitcoin software to move counterparty assets.
Got it. And for the moderately technical person out there on this podcast now, the atomic swap is this idea that you can trade without third parties in the middle, a middleman, and the transaction either passes or fails depending on the way that it's constructed. So either you get the BTC or transaction fails. Is that the main idea here?
Exactly. Yeah, it's a single transaction swap, right? Where you give your counterparty asset, the other person gives Bitcoin at some predetermined price, and or vice versa. And that's faster and safer than any alternative out there, which is arbitrarily fast and safe. And that's a really a major, major change. It makes acquiring and trading these assets much easier.
How was trading happening before? Was it more trusted, or was this multiple transactions?
It was slower. So you could always do from day one, you could use the decentralized exchange on counterparty, which is a little bit different from how people use the word decentralized exchange today, which is which is something else. But you could do the same kind of trade, the same kind of atomic swap, but only between counterparty assets and other counterparty assets, or between counterparty assets and CP. But if you wanted to trade trustlessly with Bitcoin, then you needed to, it took 6 months. You could previously buy a rare Pepe with Bitcoin trustlessly, but it took an hour. And that's unpleasant. And now you can do that same operation with Bitcoin, rare Pepe for Bitcoin or what have you, rare Pepe for rare sat in a single transaction.
Got it. Got it. Cool. And then the other two things you mentioned on the blog post, one is fair minting, which is like a quickly becoming a standard way to release tokens out into the market. And then there's something mentioned about free sub assets. Actually, that one wasn't clear to me. So, like, explain those two.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting. So a major place where value is created on counterparty is in the creation of tokens. And there's a namespacing system that was actually built while I wasn't involved called sub-assets, where you can create sort of an asset and then you can create multiple other assets under that header. The issuer of the main asset can create the can create sub-assets. And the fees for pretty much every counterparty operation were created by me 10 years ago, and I just did the dumb thing and I hard coded a value in XCP, and years ago, where the prices were very different, right? And also the sub assets didn't exist at that time, and so the protocol just wasn't ever upgraded or updated for it to make sense anymore. So now, because if you have sub assets, you don't need, starting with this protocol change, you don't need a fee to issue sub assets on an asset that you own, because there's no squatting problem, right? Because you own, it's all namespaced. So that's now free, is the long and the short of it. There's no reason for that fee to exist. It doesn't make sense for sub assets.
Got it. And then what is the actual role of the XCP token in the ecosystem?
Yeah, another thing where it's sort of a little inconsistent because of the way the protocol's changed and because the fee system was always very unsophisticated. XCP is exists to be used for all of the things that you can't just use regular Bitcoin with. If you want to do some things on counterparty, you can't use Bitcoin because you can't trustlessly escrow Bitcoin because the Bitcoin protocol doesn't know about counterparty. Counterparty knows about Bitcoin, but Bitcoin doesn't know about counterparty. So you need a native token to incentivize correct operation, to pay fees for certain operations that you can't use Bitcoin for. So, for instance, if you want to issue a named asset, you want to, like, say, I want a particular asset with a name attached to it, then there's an XCP fee attached to it. You have to pay 2 XCP to the network, and then those 2 XCP are burned. They're not paid to any foundation. They're not paid to mine. There are no miners. And then there's also, of course, a Bitcoin fee that goes to the Bitcoin miners because every counterparty transaction is a Bitcoin transaction. And that's all hunky-dory. The issue is that it's still that hard-coded 2 XCP fee from 10 years ago, which is small enough to be economically useless, but large, but it's still there. And so it creates this awkward barrier to entry because the people have to acquire XCP in order to do anything in the counterparty. And so it's really like, it's just a holdover. And one of the other things that we implemented for this protocol release was a new dynamic gas system where you can, where the fees actually start off. It's sort of a dynamic fee. It was inspired by Ethereum, where the fees are initially actually equal to zero for certain operations, for not for the atomic swaps. We haven't actually implemented it for the named asset issuances yet. It starts off at zero, and then it increases if there's a lot of usage, and it decreases if there's less than a target amount. We've only implemented that for the UTXO support for the atomic swaps at this point. And it's still zero because the usage is low. But I hope that we're able to like fix the fee system that XCP is a part of over time using this kind of dynamic calculation.
Got it. Super interesting. What is well, I guess one of the things that you guys have been working on that I noticed is new Explorer, new wallet. You know, I think it's called Horizon. Looks super clean, so good job on that. And naturally what that leads to is like, what if people are curious, what can they go do? And like, I don't know where counterparty people hang out, so I'm not even sure where to go look to go see like this marketplace or this thing. So like, I'm sure as the upgrades come, interest will increase and things will get built. But today, if people are curious about playing with like the current bleeding edge of counterparty, where does that currently exist?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's really dispersed. And what happened is that most counterparty projects don't necessarily even advertise that they're using counterparty. They just are, you know, they're just Red Pepes, or they're just Stamps, or they're just Spells of Genesis. They don't talk about the fact that they're on counterparty because counterparty itself has been so static. So where the counterparty people hang out is Telegram, which, you know, can be a bit of a shit show. It's a, you know, just lots of trolling. And then the projects are rather desperate. Like if you're using a Rare Pepe wallet, you're using a Rare Pepe wallet, and you don't even know what's running a counterparty on top of Bitcoin. And Horizon is, I mean, the reason that we're building the Horizon suite of tools, the wallet and the Explorer, and we're going to build a marketplace, is to be able to centralize and, you know, provide this sort of gateway to the counterparty ecosystem, which doesn't really exist anymore. There isn't good infrastructure. There isn't a central place that you can go to do counterparty stuff. The wallet that was built 10 years ago stopped working at the end of last year, and like no one fixed it. It's just sort of been neglected. And right now what we're doing is building up that infrastructure back up. There's some resources right now on counterparty.io. If you're interested in building something on counterparty, message me. The wallet is, we are actually going to release in an hour or two, and that will be at wallet.unspendablelabs.com. That will initially be simple functionality, just issue token, send asset, but that's a full release. And we're hoping to increase the functionality of that wallet, explore additional applications so that there actually is proper counterparty infrastructure, which today it's hard to find.
Exciting. People got a little alpha drop. This is going to drop in a little bit, but you can go back in time now and check out the wallet that just got released.
Yeah.
Very cool. So you mentioned marketplace is coming. What is on the near-term roadmap, say like 3 to 6 months out, that you guys are working on?
Yeah. There's the biggest features are probably, I mean, one big thing is we're going to change the transaction form for counterparty transactions. So you'll actually be able to multiple transactions, counterparty transactions in a single Bitcoin transaction. And thereby sort of like chain them together. It'll make fees much lower. It'll make multiple multi-step transactions much faster. It'll be really a major usability improvement. We're also going to use new encoding methods that just use the features of Bitcoin, like Taproot, that have been developed over the past 10 years to dramatically reduce transaction fees. I think that's a major thing. I mean, transaction fees in Bitcoin are substantial, especially if you're doing something fancy like with counterparty, and we want to bring those down 4x, 5x at least. That's exciting, and make them faster. We also want to implement a lot of like the standard DeFi stuff, automated market makers, liquidity pools. These are things that should exist on Bitcoin. They should exist for L2s. They should exist for counterparty assets. And there's no reason we can't build them on top of counterparty. And I think we'll get to those this year.
Interesting. Maybe I'm crossing some wires, but I think one thing that Casey did with runes is he was very much against trying to put MEV in the protocol, whatever that exactly means. I kind of understand it, but it sounds like one of the things that mitigates that is like not being able to do this multi-step transaction things in the same transaction. Do I have that right? Like runes is simplistic in that way, so it mitigates that, but you guys doing it in the way you're doing could open the gate to that, or is that not really founded?
I don't think that it would open the gate to it. I think that it's sort of a problem when you're using Bitcoin. There are actually good methods for mitigating it that are not widely used. I actually wrote a paper on the subject in 2015 on before anyone had heard of the term MEV. And we would like to implement features in we can do it in counterparty at the counterparty layer for minimizing the extractable value wherever possible. And that actually can be done pretty well. It usually is slower and more expensive in some way. But if you're making a big trade, you care a lot about getting the best price, then it can be very useful. And yeah, there are cool techniques. In general, sort of building a counterparty according to its original vision, which was to enable the creation of value, the transfer of value, financial applications, we're actually dealing with things that have value. That's a lot of the center of the ethos of counterparty and what it's really good at and what blockchains are really good at. And all of that innovation that's occurred off-chain, off Bitcoin, can also happen on Bitcoin, and protocols like counterparty are a really great way to do it.
Interesting. Okay, I'm definitely going to link. I'm going to read that paper and link to it, because I think one of the things that stands out to me reading some of your work is that, first of all, you're a good writer. But your clarity of thinking is really clear. It just like makes sense. Like, yeah, that there's not a bunch of fluff. It's just very logical and cohesive. So that's nice in a white paper. There's a lot of bullshit in my white papers. So from your perspective, and this is kind of like we can close with this question. What are you most excited about right now in Bitcoin? Like there's tons of stuff going on, roll ups and opcode upgrades and opcat and meta, a billion things. What are you most hyped about right now that's going on in Bitcoin?
Yeah, it's the L2 space generally. I think all of that tech is really great. I've played a lot with it, and a lot of the fancy tech that's been developed over the past 10 years in the blockchain space generally. I'm most interested in a healthy ecosystem and interoperability, true interoperability, which has been a phantasm, right? People say the word interoperability a lot. What they usually mean is like standardization, API standardization, but actually having the ability to trade assets for one another, to have a healthy, dynamic, interconnected ecosystem which is trustless and decentralized, it still doesn't really exist. L2s are still too competitive with each other, right? They're trying to get market share and mind share, and they're trying to pump their coins. And it doesn't need to be that way. I think that the best thing is to create a virtuous cycle where you have value, creating value, and everyone benefits from it.
That's a great answer. Any other thing you want to touch on as we close out that I didn't ask?
No. I'm very excited about what's happening with Counterparty. It's been a long road to get here. I mean, over in the initial launch, the eight year hiatus, and then this past year, it's been a lot of behind the scenes development work on the core network node, and very, very excited for the new protocol release and the features that are coming out over the next couple months for Counterparty and what they mean for the broader L2 ecosystem and Bitcoin itself, not just for any one product.
Very cool. Well, I'll have a bunch of links below so people can educate themselves and be closer to the Counterparty ecosystem, but I'm excited to watch it flourish. And I totally agree. Like the interoperability piece is like the gold standard, but everyone's kind of doing it in hackneyed ways, centralized bridges and all this stuff. So
yeah,
glad some people are working on it and thinking about it at the right level so that hopefully, down the road, we'll actually have that come to fruition. So yeah, this has been a great chat, Adam. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening this far into the episode. If you found it enjoyable, please do like, subscribe on whatever platform that you're listening on. YouTube does me a huge favor to like and subscribe. Find me on Twitter at Jake Blockchain. Show me some love. I reply to every DM. And if you are a Bitcoin builder that is kind of at the forefront of building new use cases, whether it's L1, Lightning, Stacks, Rootstock, Rollups, Ordinals, BRC20, I want to talk to you. So when I'm not doing this podcast, I am the sourcing partner at the Bitcoin Frontier Fund, where we invest in Bitcoin startups at the earliest stages, give you access to whatever you need, whether it's legal, product, fundraising help, as well as capital. So love to talk to you. You can hit me up. Again, find me on Twitter at Jake Blockchain and shoot me a DM. I'll read everything. Love to talk to you guys. All right, peace. It's gone up. We playing the long game to the black rock chains with the racks paid off from the blockchain. Going up high octane, so we up in here like pomade. Making big noise, big money. Go play with your kid toys. You funny, I'm counting my Bitcoin. We up and we been gone. It's gone. Planned it out and we did this purposefully. Panning out like the kitchen currently. It's like surgery. Way it's earning me. A nurse's salary for cryptocurrency. I'm on a vacay drinking coconuts while wearing polka dots. This ain't no hocus pocus. Listen up and learn. It's gone up.